Thanks for listening to the podcast from Faith Radio Mornings.
Start your day connecting faith to life with Faith Radio Mornings. Let it rise.
Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour, and a very happy Friday to you. We're so glad, I am glad, that you're listening today. It is Friday, May 19th already. And tomorrow, May 20th, my mama's birthday. Happy birthday, Mama, because I'm not going to be on the air tomorrow, so I just want to say that now. And I don't know what your plans are for the summer. Do you have vacations planned? That's the big question. I'm going to give you some stress-free tips regarding travel. Tip one, stay home. Tip two, see tip one. Tip three, reminisce about that trip to the fun park, which produced that court-ordered anger management class. That'll help you with your travel plans this summer. And if you're like me and you're like typing out a quick text on the phone and you're going fast and maybe you your thumbs are hitting the wrong buttons and your spell checker produces words that you have no idea when you go back to read the text. You read it and you go, I don't even know what I'm trying to say right now. Yesterday, I'm writing this text and I'm typing in a text, the word scripture search. And I finished the text and I went back and looked at it. In place of scripture search was the word Seattle Ching. I thought, I have no idea what I was trying to say right there. Does that happen to you?
Yeah.
You're probably a better texter than I am.
Well, I still suffer from the dumb thumb sometimes.
The dumb thumb.
And it just like, yeah, I guess that's what kids call it these days. I don't know. I'm not cool enough to know. But the one that pops to my mind immediately when you said that was I was trying to type out some sort of recipe or grocery list or something. I was trying to type the terms lemon juice.
What
came
up? Simple
enough. Do you want to know what came up?
I kind of do.
Lenin Justice is what came
there
up
you go.
Instead of lemon juice. And I thought immediately I regret all my life choices.
But then you go back and read the text and you see Lenin Justice and then you can't figure out what you were trying
like,
to type.
I have no
right?
idea. How am I supposed to make cookies now? That's my
exactly,
question.
Exactly. Exactly. So I'm going to, I think, maybe open up a new restaurant called Seattle Ching.
I like that.
I do too. I don't know what it's going to serve, but
neither will anyone else.
No, but burgers maybe. Who knows what? Good coffee, because you got to have good coffee.
Of course.
Yeah. Most people in the morning like good coffee. And if that's you and you're enjoying your cup while listening to this show, you're doing all the right things. Just make sure you start with God's Word and open your Bible and make sure you get the teaching and the training that you need, because we're going to we got an incredible hour coming up right now. We're going to talk to Senator Tom Coburn in just a minute. And then a little bit later in the hour, J. Warner Wallace, who is getting to be one of my favorite apologists. I heard Jim speak several years ago, and I walked out of there going, okay, that might be one of the best presentations on the case for Christianity that I've seen in a long time. And he's written another book, and I think it's called Forensic Faith. And he's a retired detective, homicide detective from Los Angeles, and he's got a powerful brain, and we're going to dig into it. Coming up in the second hour here on the Big Morning Show. So we're going to take a break, and then we're going to speak to a senator. How cool is that? All right, I'm all nervous. We'll be back in just a minute. Eight minutes after the hour, good morning. Bill Arnold here with you, and we have got a great second hour. We had a great first hour, but if you're just getting up and just getting moving, welcome to the show. We've got retired Senator Tom Coburn on the line. He was a practicing physician in Oklahoma until 2015. He served as a U.S. representative of Oklahoma from 95 to 01, and he also served two terms in the Senate, and he is on the studio line right now. Senator, good morning.
Morning, Bill. How are you?
Good. Now, just so you know, I'm an old school, hard line, open with a gotcha question kind of interviewer. So you went to Oklahoma State for college and then the University of Oklahoma for medical school. So my question is, what football team has your allegiance?
Well, they both do, except when they play each other, and then I pull for Oklahoma State.
Okay. That's a great, great answer. I love it. Your new book, Smashing the DC Monopoly. And how you have fought for a long time to try to cut spending and pork out of the system. Thank you for doing that. I want to say if we had every senator was like you, we'd be in good shape right now as a country.
Well, you're kind to say that. No, the way we do that is through Article 5 of the Constitution, and it is the only solution that's big enough for the problems that face our country. And I don't think you can fix Washington in Washington. I think we in the states have to fix it, and we do that by what our founders knew we would eventually need to do, which is an amendments convention to restore the Constitution to its original intent.
So how can the people, how do we rebalance the government system and try to figure out how to deal with this runaway dysfunction that's in Washington?
Well, I mean, first thing to think about is, did our founders ever intend all the power to be in Washington, not much of the power to be in the states? It's
right.
Just the opposite of what they intended. So what I believe is you have to do three things. One is you have to limit the scope and jurisdiction of the federal government. In other words, restore the Commerce Clause as it was intended. You have to force a balanced budget amendment on the members of Congress. They won't ever make the hard choices till we make them make the hard choices. And you do that by an amendment that says you will use generally accepted accounting principles and you will balance the budget, period. They don't make the hard choices because they really are more interested in getting reelected than making hard choices. And then finally, you limit their terms so that we actually have people of experience in the real world instead of career politicians, which is what 70% of Congress has never had a real job. So if you do those three things, what you will do is you will restore the balance of power between the three branches, one, and the balance of power between the states and the federal government. Because essentially, the courts control everything in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
We hear all the news about about the president and the Congress. Congress has ceded most of its power to the executive branch. And consequently, what you come under is people making decisions for your lives that have never been elected to anything, but they're a bureaucrat in Washington that have the power to tell us what we can and can't do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not freedom. That's not liberty. And the real question is, who gets to decide your future? It should be you.
Yeah.
It shouldn't be an unelected bureaucrat.
No, I'm with
you. So that's what it's all about. And conventionofstates.com is the website. We have 2.2 million volunteers right now and activists. We're growing that. We hope to be at about 10 million this time next year. And we have 12 states that have already passed this resolution asking for the identical same thing, an amendments convention to consider three things. And we have to get to 34. And once you do that, the Congress has to call this meeting. And then whatever comes out of that meeting within those guidelines comes back to the states, and the states either approve it or no.
That's really encouraging. So I'm going to talk about the moral side of this, what I think is probably, and a lot of people agree with, just the absolute corruption in government, where we don't feel like we can trust government, and yet government is such an important part of how we function as a society. So what's the moral side of all this?
Well, I think there's several. One is in our Declaration of Independence, is we talk about the God-given rights that we have, and they've been abused. So that's number one. Number two is the immorality of stealing the future from the next two generations. And if you think about the $124 trillion that our children and grandchildren are going to have to come up with because we haven't lived within our means, that's going to imply a significantly large drop in their standard of living, about 30%.
Mm-hmm.
So ask yourself how moral it is for people to stay in Washington today, not actually address the real problems facing the country. I'm talking unfunded mandates, Medicare is bankrupt, Social Security is going to be bankrupt, Medicaid we don't have the money to pay for, retirement for military we don't have the money to pay for. How moral is it to steal that money from the future of our kids rather than us to pay for it because we encountered the obligation?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the immorality is rampant. The other thing is if you look at it legally and historically, the Congress is doing things they were never intended to do. It was supposed to be done at the state level.
Yeah.
We've usurped the state power. So These are all fixable problems. Great hope. If we can get the 34 states that are needed to call an amendments convention, we can actually fix our country, and we can put limits on the politicians in Washington, and we can say, we're going to give you a spine. You have to do this because we have now a constitutional amendment. You have to live within your means. And the very few want to do that because it's so, you look so good bringing something home to Minnesota.
No kidding. Yeah.
Yeah. Except you don't because you're, you know, it's which shell is the pea under?
Right.
And it's
one on the left.
Right.
Yeah. All right. Senator Coburn, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, I want to ask more about the people of faith, that they're trying to promote integrity and responsibility within the government, how we're doing. We're going to check on that. It's 15 minutes after the hour. I'll be right back with Senator Tom Coburn. Eighteen minutes after the hour. Good morning. I'm here speaking with Senator Tom Coburn, and he went to OSU and OU, and I went to IOU, and you aren't graduating. Those are the two schools I went to, Tom. But you had managed, as a senator, to reveal $400 billion per year in waste, fraud, and duplication as a senator, and we already miss you desperately in Washington.
Well, the tragedy of that is when you take all that the Government Accountability Office has said is fact, and you take it to members of Congress of both parties, and you say, help me get rid of this. And they say, I don't know. You know, there's a constituency for that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, even though it's fraud, even though it's waste, even though it's duplication, they don't have the courage to stand up and eliminate it. So that tells you we have some real, real problems with the real action of the people we send to Washington to represent us versus what the press releases they put out.
Mm-hmm.
And so having people in Washington who actually have the character traits and the courage, you know, most of the people go to Washington because they need to be liked instead of want to solve the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're looking for strokes.
Mm-hmm.
And what we really need is real problem solvers, people who aren't afraid of criticism. And, you know, it's okay to be criticized if you're standing on principle.
Mm-hmm.
And we just don't have the kind of character-based sacrificial leadership that is required for our times today. So that's why we, as the citizens, have to join together and actually put forward these resolutions in our state houses. And once we get to 34 states, then Congress has to call an amendments convention of the states.
Mm-hmm.
And then we can actually fix things. But they're not going to get fixed in Washington. That's the reason I left Washington. I left 2 years early because I could see that I could sit there and keep working, but it wasn't going to make a difference because the people who were there were motivated to a totally different set of principles.
So, Tom, how does Washington respond when you're telling them things that they just absolutely don't want to hear?
Well, first of all, they don't want to hear it, so they quit listening.
Okay.
And number two, unless you embarrass them on the floor of the Senate or in a committee hearing, they don't move. And so the fact is getting reelected is more important to the vast majority of senators than doing what's in the best long-term interest of the country. And I know that's a harsh statement.
It is.
It's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. And so all you have to do is just go look up your senators and say, what's their priorities right now?
Mm-hmm.
Is it fixing Medicare? Is it fixing Social Security? Is it eliminating the deficit so that we're not borrowing against our kids again? Is it securing the future and maintaining the possibility for prosperity for our kids? No, it's getting reelected. And making myself look good by trying to make somebody else look bad.
Mm-hmm. I don't like that formula.
Well, that's what we have, and that's why I left, and that's why I think we need to fix. We need to utilize what our founders gave us. And as a matter of fact, Colonel George Mason stood up in the Constitutional Convention and said the following: "Gentlemen, we've made a grievous error. Do you know of any government in history that has voluntarily ceded power back to the people? And, of course, nobody could give that. They were all very learned men. Nobody could give them an answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, therefore, the only thing in the Constitution that didn't have vigorous debate was this subsection of Article 5 that allowed the states to call an amendments convention.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read Madison's notes, he said this is the only thing we didn't, that we just, everybody agreed to. You know, everybody just said, you're right, we've got to do this. And so, therefore, we as citizens have the right through our state legislators to call a convention to amend the Constitution. And it's not to change, it's to restore it, to put it back. The principles were right. The courts and the government have moved away from it. The original Constitution you can have in a pocket. You can carry in your pocket.
Mm-hmm.
The actual annotated Constitution weighs 87 pounds.
Wow.
And that's fine print, double-sided.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all the changes that all the courts have done through the years to take away the freedom and liberties and state rights that were supposed to be guaranteed.
So, Tom, how can people of integrity, people of faith, how do we stand for righteousness in this political chaotic world right now?
Well, I think first of all is how you, you know, if we're loved by God, and we are, we're His creation, and we've experienced His grace, then our number one goal has to be to share that grace and love people. But you can love people and still be very stern about their behavior and say, this is the wrong behavior and this is the wrong motivation. And so standing up and making a difference in your community by loving people, not shunning them, but loving them, and doing it in a way that says, this is the principle, this is how we do it. You know, there's a wonderful book written by Marvin Olasky 20 years ago called The Tragedy of American Compassion. And he outlines how we, in the first 175 years of our existence, took care of people without undermining their own personal responsibility. And if you look at the war on poverty that started in 1965, the poverty rate was 19.2% in our country. It's 19.8% now, and we spent $37 trillion. So if, in fact, we lead as Jesus would have us to lead, then we would be loving our neighbor and loving our God. That means sacrificing for our neighbor and sacrificing for our God and treating people with respect, but at the same time holding them accountable.
Tom, your book, Smashing the D.C. Monopoly and Using Article 5 to Restore Freedom and Stop Runaway Government, is looks like a great book. I'm sorry I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but there is a solution out there, and this is a great place to do it, and we'll continue to pray for this movement to restore freedom. Thank you so much for being on the show.
You bet, Bill.
Yeah.
God bless you, and I hope you have a great day.
Yeah, and same to you, and don't spend too much of your day bragging about the fact you were on my show, okay?
I won't. I promise.
Have a great weekend. Thanks, Senator.
All right, you too.
All right.
Bye.
25 minutes after the hour, we'll take a short break and be back. We've got coming up in the second hour, Jay Warner Wallace. You're going to love that. Be back in a minute. Half past the hour, when we come back, we're going to talk to Jay Warner Wallace. He's got a new book out, and it's called Forensic Faith, on how to be how to make a great case for Christ and Christianity, and how to strengthen our walk and our witness. You're not going to want to miss this. He is one of my favorites. Be back in a minute. Minutes until the top of the hour. We are all a work in progress. Apologist and author Lee Strobel reminds us to give ourselves grace when we fall short of God's best.
We still sin, and we wish we didn't, but even the Apostle Paul said, why do I keep doing things that I know I shouldn't do? We still sin, and then we condemn ourselves because we know we shouldn't, we know better, and then we feel like God is kind of turning his back on us, or we're afraid to connect deeply with God because, after all, I should be over the sin by now, or I shouldn't have done that, and yet I did. And I think that understanding that we are works in progress, that it's going to be three steps forward, one step back, and that in this world we're going to have trouble, as Jesus told us we will, and we're not always going to respond in the perfect way, but you know what? We have a perfect Father. And he's the one who will hold us in his hand and draw us close, even those times when we feel like we failed and we've fallen short, which we have. But you know what? He loves us, and his forgiveness is ever flowing and fresh every morning.
You can find that full interview on our website at myfaithradio.com. Just type in Lee Strobel. I bet you'll get there. He is a great author and apologist. And now, coming up next, another great author and apologist, J. Warner Wallace. We'll be back in just a minute.
Back in my day, bullies were confined to name-calling at lunchtime, taunts on the playground. But today, bullies have way more tools of torment at their disposal. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. You know, there's probably nothing that makes me more angry than when I see kids going at each other in a slugfest. But these days, cyberbullies are far more prevalent. Teens post insults on message boards, send threats through text messages, spread rumors via Facebook. To cut someone down, all a bully needs is an internet connection and a little imagination. So, Mom, Dad, keep tabs on your teen, not only to protect him, but to make sure you don't have a bully right under your roof.
Mark Gregston has prepared a brand new resource to help parents draw their teens closer, not push them away. Download your free copy online at parentingtodaysteens.org.
Good morning. It's almost 22, the top of the hour. Wouldn't you love to be able to answer all the tough questions and do it well and be a good listener and be inquisitive and know how to get to the root of someone's problems and concerns? We've got J. Warner Wallace on the studio line. Really an amazing thinker and a great author. He's got a new book called Forensic Faith. He is a cold case homicide detective. Residing in the Los Angeles area. He's been on Dateline and Fox News. I've seen him on both. And he's a former atheist, and he's the author of Cold Case Christianity and God's Crime Scene. And now the trilogy is complete with a book called Forensic Faith. Jim, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
No, you're just one of my favorites. I saw you present in person about 3 years ago, and I walked out of there, and I thought, okay, that might be one of the best presentations for learning how to share your faith and defend your faith I've ever seen.
Wow. Well, I appreciate you saying that. We're just trying to really kind of think about how each of us can do a better job of that, right? Because a lot of folks don't even know why or can't even imagine why we would need to do it, why we would even need to take time to understand what the evidence is for our faith. But I think it is important in the culture we're in right now.
But your background and as a homicide detective and the way you think and the way you've been trained is such a fascinating application to sharing Christ with others.
Well, it's kind of my own personal journey. Like Lee, you were saying, right? Lee had an experience,
yeah,
which we all now have seen in the movie Case for Christ, and we kind of understand that informs his process then, and that was true for me too. I was 35 before I ever even looked at the Gospels seriously, and by that time I already had a skill set in place as an investigator that was, I just couldn't look at it any other way. I almost feel like that was part of my DNA. So I've tried to transfer that to others because after becoming a Christian, I thought, well, isn't this how everyone becomes a Christian?
You know, no.
They examine the Gospels to see if they're reliable and they use the skill set. And so, yeah, it was probably the only way I could even begin to imagine showing it to others.
And one of the things, Jim, I've been so encouraged by your work is you really do want to help equip people to go out and rely on their training. You can go out and try to share your faith, but if you go out and rely on your training because you've done the work, you're going to be much more effective. I don't know if you're like me, but I was a big fan of the first Rambo movie.
Yeah.
And I remember that one epic scene, and it took about 12 minutes, where he escaped from the sheriff's office, and then he was out in the wilderness, and he dismantled one by one the entire sheriff's department. And I thought, he's relying on his training right now.
Well, I can tell you that it's muscle memory for a lot of us, right?
So absolutely.
We do the same thing over and over and over and over again. So that by the time we're in a crisis situation where maybe we're distracted and we don't have, you know, access to, you know, to be able to focus entirely in a calm situation, well, now we're relying on things we've done so many times that we're just doing them as a matter of a second nature. And if you think about it, most of the time when we're in conversation with people about what we believe, it may be for a lot of us the first time we've ever had that kind of conversation or answered that kind of question. So I found for me that because I'm constantly thinking about these things and I'm having these conversations in my head over and over and over again, by the time I get to a real conversation where somebody's asking those questions, I feel like I've asked and answered them for myself 1,000 times. And then it makes it a little easier for me using muscle memory to respond for somebody else. And so that's why I do think it's important for us to worship God with more than our songs and more than our prayers and more than even our actions. We could worship God with our mind by giving him our thoughts and spending time thinking deeply about, you know, how we, number one, would answer the questions that our friends have, and also just, you know, thinking about the theology of the Christian worldview. And I think that's something that in some ways is missing right now from the equation for many of us as Christians.
Yeah, Jim, now you talk about the difference between accidental and evidential belief. And for a lot of people, you know, they say, well, you know, I believe in God because I was raised in a Christian family. And for a lot of people that you're trying to share faith with, that isn't quite enough. They go, well, a lot of people are raised in certain environments, and if that's why you believe, that doesn't seem good enough. So you talk about the difference between accidental and evidential belief. Say more.
Yeah, you're right about that. I mean, I started asking people around the country, well, why are you a Christian? Just so I can know where we're starting from. And the answers, I was surprised at the kind of answers I was getting over and over and over again. I got to the point where I could predict for pastors what their congregations were going to say. And it's always in these three categories. You know, number one, I was raised in the church is the most popular answer you're going to get. I was always a Christian. My parents were Christians, and that makes sense, and I can understand that. Two, I've had an experience that confirmed for me that Christianity was true. I prayed for something, or I saw something miraculous. Those are both good answers. And the third I usually get is something like, you know, I used to be a jerk, and I met Jesus, and I'm not so much a jerk anymore. So, that's a, you know, some act of transformation. But what struck me about those answers is that, you know, although my family is just mostly all atheists, I have my dad remarried and his second wife is Mormon, and he's got 6 kids with that second wife, and those 6 kids were all raised LDS. And if you ask them, why are you a Mormon, they give you the same 3 answers in about the same order. You know, they were really raised this way, of course they were, but they all will say they've had some experience of the Holy Spirit that confirmed for them the Book of Mormon was true. And so these are the kinds of answers that pretty much everyone gives, regardless of what, you know, theistic worldview you hold. And I just thought, you know, should our answers be like everyone else? We don't believe those systems are true, but why do our answers then sound like theirs? Mm-hmm. It seems to me we could do better, given the fact that our worldview is grounded in the event called the resurrection of Jesus. And if that didn't happen, the whole thing is a sham. Mm-hmm. And of course, it did happen. And we could actually talk about it in a way that I think is more than just, well, you know, in my opinion, or I've had this personal subjective experience, or in my upbringing. These are all subjective approaches. And by the way, you know this, as objective truth claims of a culture that is increasingly secular, because they'll make these claims as though their claims are objective. If we respond as though our claims are subjective, well, get ready to surrender your claims.
Mm-hmm.
Because this, you know, the idea that the desire for to be treated without any discrimination at all runs up against your religious liberties. Your religious liberties are going to cave if people feel like they are grounded not in what's objectively true, but in what is a subjective matter of opinion for you.
Mm-hmm. Jim, do you think people can still be a strong Christian if they can't defend in what they believe?
Oh, I think your commitment is another issue altogether. You absolutely can. And I don't think this was a requirement for salvation either, in the sense that mm-hmm. you could be in the right place, but not even know why you're in the right place. You could be there accidentally. You could happen to be in a system that is true, but not really know why it's true.
Mm-hmm.
And that may be fine in terms of your own, where you stand with God yourself. But here's my question. Most of us, people who would say, I don't need this, Jim, I already know it's true, and it is true, so I'm in the right place, and I don't have that desire to know with that kind of precision. Really? Well, I'll bet you there's someone in your family, probably a millennial or Gen Z, somebody who's a little younger, because that's the group that is leaving the church in record numbers.
Mm.
And that they are continuing, the attrition rate is terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of it will help us, as those folks, for the most part, by the time they're in junior high, had questions, and not about what we believed, Mom and Dad, but why do you believe it? And they're not going to read Jim Wallis or Lee Strobel or anybody like that. They want to know first and foremost, Mom, Dad, tell me, why is this true? And we show over a long period of time that we don't really have the same reasons that their professors seem to offer for why their worldview is true. And by the way, their worldview allows them the freedom to do all kinds of stupid things morally. Well, guess what's going to happen? They're going to leave the one worldview that's restricting them for the worldview that isn't, especially if that worldview seems more reasonable anyway. We need to have a more reasonable evidential faith.
I'm talking to J. Warner Wallace. His latest book, Forensic Faith. We're going to continue our conversation after a short break. It's quarter until the top of the hour. We'll be right back. Twelve minutes until the top of the hour. Bill Arnold here with you talking to J. Warner Wallace. His latest book, Forensic Faith. He was a homicide detective. His father was a detective. His son is a detective. Jim, if I were a criminal, who should I fear the most?
I wonder sometimes if my daughter, who's coming up right now, she's in the Marine Corps, is probably the one who will...
She's the tough one, huh?
She becomes a cop. She might be the worst one to fear of all the Wallaces, but for now...
Oh, that's hilarious.
My son Jimmy is still out there doing the job on a daily basis, so he's probably the one we should fear.
Yeah. I was up late last night reading your book. I love the way you think. I love your heart. You don't seem like an author that wants to write books so you can sell and make money. You seem like a guy that genuinely wants to equip people to know how to respond to people to share their faith. I just love the way you work.
Well, and that was part of it for me was that I came to this late. I became a Christian late, and I felt like I was behind the curve. And when I discovered that people really didn't ever think that there was any connection between, a lot of people don't understand the connection between evidence and what you believe as a Christian, then I thought, well, let me see what I can do. This is the one area that I might be able to participate and contribute something. And yeah, you're right. I mean, for us. I have a pension. This is all about ministry. We're trying to figure out, well, what has God called us to do in this season? Because I could very easily, my agency still has, we still have several open unsolveds that I started that I could go back, and maybe someday I'll do that, go back and finish, but they're so time-consuming that, they would love to have me come back and just work cold cases until I can't, breathe anymore. But I think it's time for us now to take a turn and talk about, well, how does this approach to deciding? Because remember, every case I've worked had unanswered questions. Every case you go to trial with, there's not a single prosecutor's ever gone to trial with any case in which there weren't significant unanswered questions that he had to help his jury overcome. Mm-hmm. And we ask jurors all the time, are you the kind of person who can't make a decision unless you have every question answered? If you say yes, I don't think I can do that, then we're not going to put you on the panel because we know that we're going to have unanswered questions. So I guess you could make a claim then that in every criminal trial, we make a decision without all the answers. Now, that sometimes is called a step of faith, but it's an informed step. It's yes, you're right, we're going to make a step across a void if we can't answer some of these questions, but it's not as though it's blind. We've got good evidence indicating that this is true, even though we don't have every piece of evidence we might like, and so we make a decision. And that's really the kind of faith that Jesus was describing. I mean, he consistently, as a case maker, he consistently said, look, if you don't believe what I'm telling you, at least believe the evidence of these miracles. And he spent 40 days with the disciples after the resurrection, providing them with all the quote-unquote convincing proofs that they would need to be able to make the case when he was gone. And I looked at that and said, you know what, that's a view, that's an approach to thinking that I can accept, because that's what we do in every criminal trial. And here's Jesus 2,000 years earlier doing the same thing with his disciples. I felt very at home in that worldview.
I bet you did. And it's really the collection of evidence that we make decisions based on, because I think a lot of Christians feel intimidated. What if I get a question I can't answer? I'm going to look like a fool. And we don't have to fear that, do we?
Well, when that happens, here's what you do. Well, we all do. The same thing happens in every kind of when a prosecutor says, well, dude, before I file this case, tell me, how do I answer this? Well, I don't know yet. Give me 2 weeks. I'll get back to you, and I'll see what we can find out. I hadn't thought of that. So, okay. So now I spend the next 2 weeks trying to answer that question for the prosecutor so he can be comfortable or she can be comfortable trying the case. Well, the same thing happens with our friends. Yeah, you're going to get questions you can't answer, of course. Thank God for those questions, because guess what? That's going to cause you now to learn something you don't know. Mm-hmm. And now you're going to go out. Now, don't think there's not an answer for those questions. There are. You just weren't ready. That's okay. as long as you don't, you know, on the fly say something stupid that's not true, the best thing you can say is, that's a great question. I know there's an answer out there. People have been talking about this stuff for 2,000 years. Let me get back to you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you do. Then you spend time studying.
Yeah, Jim, what do you think about some Christians that they start to investigate and get answers to defend their faith, and they start to feel very challenged, and they start to maybe even lose some of their faith once they start looking for answers to defend it?
Well, this is why, for the most part, you got to be careful when you start. But what do you know? Here's a problem I have, is that when most of us, when we work a case book and as a cold case investigator, we don't do anything until I've read that thing cover to cover two or three times. Then I make a copy of it. So the original sits unmarked on the shelf. I now have a copy, and I start mark up the copy. So I'm so familiar with what the case says before I start that when somebody else comes along later on and says something sideways, I recognize it right away. It's a counterfeit because I know the original so well. Now, that will allow me. So here's the problem I have with most of us. You and I both know that how many times have we or our friends started to read the Bible cover to cover, and we're feeling good about it. You know, and we're in Genesis, we're in Exodus, and then we hit Leviticus, and we're like, okay, let's skip over here now. Before you know it, you've skipped into Proverbs.
Right.
The problem is we haven't spent time learning our case.
Right.
We got to do that first.
I couldn't agree more. And what about, and you make an interesting point in your book about the case that if God's in control, how much do I have to know if he's going to be the one that's going to turn someone's mind? You give a really delightful example of your son trying to convince him the value of a mushroom pizza. I thought that was just brilliant.
Yeah, that's the only. It's hard, right? Because this balance between God's sovereignty and our free agency is something that no one's really ever satisfactorily resolved, probably as much as we'd like. But here's my lame attempt at doing that. It is all God, in the sense that I my son for a lot of years would not eat mushrooms. So if getting saved required you to voluntarily order a mushroom pizza, he would never get saved,
mm-hmm.
because he would never do that because of his hatred of mushrooms. So I can make a case for mushroom pizza till I'm blue in the face. It would have no impact on him. He would not move. Now, if there was a way, though, to remove his enmity of mushrooms, well, then suddenly my case for mushroom pizza might be successful, because the first thing I had to do is remove his hatred of mushrooms. I can't do that. But if there's a God that could miraculously remove his enmity, then my efforts become successful. And you might argue, well, okay, so you see now that God's doing something first in softening the heart of my son in this issue. But why even need me at all? Couldn't God go all the way from start to finish? Of course he could. But he's using me, evidentially, to make the case. Why would he do that? Well, because he loves two people in that room. He loves the kid who he just removed the enmity from, and he's saving that kid by drawing him to himself. And that is an act of salvation that is grace, all God's grace, top down. But he also loves me enough to know that in my effort to learn more about him, to study all the evidence, I am becoming closer and closer and more. It's a sanctification process for me. And that's all God, too, because he doesn't need me to do this. He could just turn all of us on with a flip of a switch.
Mm-hmm.
So it turns out it's his love of both of us to save one of us and to mature the other that's occurring in that room. It's all God from the beginning, start to finish. But he is using us as the means by which we can reach a lost world. And if we do it in this way, I think we are well within the rich, robust, evidential history of Christianity.
You know, Jim, that was just a great illustration that really stuck in my head. And it excited me to be reminding myself that I need to pray that God will in a sovereign way lift the enmity that is in a person's spirit so that I can show up and be an effective case maker in this process. So that was really encouraging. So thank you for this great book, Forensic Faith. I love you, Jay Warner Wallace. You're one of the people I really look forward to your work and your testimony and all you're doing. So thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for having me on your show. I so appreciate you.
You bet. Thanks so much. All right, a couple minutes until the top of the hour, and I just can't say enough about Forensic Faith. And Jay Warner Wallace is the author of Cold Case Christianity and God's Crime Scene. It's a great book. All right, a couple minutes until the top of the hour. If you've got to have to be at work and get going, or if you're having a day off, congratulations. Enjoy it. It's going to be a little chillier on the upper Midwest, but it's going to be, I think, a good weekend, I think. And maybe think about getting Forensic Faith by J. Warner Wallace. I read it last night, and I can't wait to go back through it again. It's a great book. And it says in the book of James, who is wise and understanding among you? Let them show it by their good life, by deeds done in the humility that comes from wisdom. Have a great weekend.
Thanks for listening to this Faith Radio Mornings podcast. These conversations are available because of listener support. You can make your gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of Faith Radio Mornings, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or on your podcast player. And thanks for sharing the audio link with a friend and growing the impact of Faith Radio Mornings.